Welcome to This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Germany's government announces marriage equality legislation, hints of liberation fuel anti-queer violence in Uganda, and a Reagan Remembrances reality check. All that and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Christopher Gall.
And I'm Cindy Friedman.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending June 12, 2004. Germany's Social Democratic government will be introducing bills to extend nearly all the benefits and responsibilities of marriage to same-gender couples, the Justice Minister announced this week. The first bill will come within the next 3 months, according to Brigitte Zaprius, who told the Berliner Zeitung newspaper, "Gay and lesbian couples are a social reality in Germany. Therefore, we will grant them the same rights as heterosexual couples. They will enjoy the same constitutional rights and be treated equally. The one exception is that gay and lesbian couples will not be able to adopt unrelated children together, although one partner will be able to co-adopt the other's biological children." The ruling Social Democrats believe they can sidestep the conservative majority in the upper house, the Bundesrat, by splitting the couple's rights expansion into two legislative packages, the first including those items the Bundesrat does not have the power to veto. The Bundesrat can veto bills relating to taxation and did so in 2002 when the government proposed equal treatment for same-gender couples. Zaprius admits it will still be an uphill fight there for this year's second planned legislative package. Germany established much more limited registered life partnerships for gays and lesbians in 2001. The coming legislation would confer status equal to heterosexual marriage in areas including taxation, inheritance, property, immunity from giving court testimony against their partners, and support following dissolution.
Switzerland's bill to create registered partnerships for gay and lesbian couples has passed its last parliamentary hurdle, Swiss Info reported. The upper house voted its approval in principle last week. The partnerships will confer next of kin status in areas including inheritance, pensions, health insurance, taxation, and immigration, but will not allow for marriage, fertility treatment, or couple adoption. A small religious right party, the Federal Democratic Union, is confident that it can obtain enough signatures to require a national referendum on the issue.
A constitutional amendment to restrict legal marriage to heterosexual couples has been introduced in the Marianas Islands. There will be a public hearing later this month, but Speaker of the House Benigno Fitial expects little opposition to his proposal in the predominantly Catholic Pacific Ocean nation.
Leading Anglican conservatives severely denounced the affirmation of gay and lesbian relationships by last week's Canadian Synod, even though that meeting stalled for at least 3 years any action on church blessings for same-gender couples in an attempt to maintain unity in the global communion. As a kind of consolation prize for gays and lesbians, the Canadian Synod passed a resolution affirming the sanctity and integrity of committed same-gender relationships. But Archbishop of the West Indies Drexel Gomez called it completely unacceptable to use the term holy, saying that conferred theological status equal to marriage. Canadians responded that their resolution had never been intended as a theological statement, but this week Gomez was joined by the top Anglicans of 21 other church provinces, more than half its regions, in a statement drafted by South America's primate Gregory Venables that called the Canadian action devastating. It said bluntly, "We would like to see them expelled. This is going against Christian teaching, and they should either repent or shut the door behind themselves."
Last week's first-ever same-gender marriage in France has spawned numerous legal actions. As expected, Bordeaux State Prosecutor Bertrand Deloz has filed to nullify the marriage of Bertrand Charpentier and Stéphane Chapin, and the chief judge there has indicated they will have to appear. The couple is prepared to take their case to the European Court of Human Rights if necessary. Prime Minister Jean-Pierre Raffarin continued to speak out against Bègue Lemaire and Green Member of Parliament Noël Mamère for performing the marriage, declaring that the state which I represent as Prime Minister cannot accept that a public sector employee should be able to take decisions against the law. Interior Minister Dominique de Villepin began proceedings immediately after the wedding to punish Mamère with a fine or suspension, but indicated this week the government would probably not try to permanently remove him from office. But Mamère also took action this week, introducing a draft bill in the French Parliament to open legal marriage to same-gender couples. Ma Mère, unlike the French government, believes existing law does not prohibit those marriages, but his new bill would explicitly legalize them.
Another marrying mayor, Jason West of New Paltz, New York, was the subject of two somewhat conflicting court decisions this week. First, a state judge made permanent the court order prohibiting West from performing further marriages of same-gender couples in what's believed to be the first such permanent injunction ever issued in the U.S. Ulster County Justice Michael Kavanaugh ruled rather narrowly in the case, not making any statement on the constitutional status of those marriages in New York, but declaring that an elected official may willfully violate a law any time he or she believes it is unconstitutional has profound and unsettling implications. While the conservative legal groups that had sought the injunction celebrated, West's attorney planned to appeal Kavanaugh's decision. But it was a different story altogether when New Paltz Town Court Justice Jonathan Katz dismissed 19 misdemeanor counts the Ulster County prosecutor had levied against West for marrying gay and lesbian couples without licenses. In his much broader ruling, Katz found that there was no rational basis for denying same-gender couples their constitutional right to equal treatment under the law in the case of marriage. That was a first for New York, although 7 civil lawsuits regarding same-gender marriage are underway in other state courts. District Attorney Donald Williams intends to appeal Katz's ruling, but West has always taken the position that he was being true to his oath of office to uphold the state constitution, overriding a discriminatory marriage law. Since West was first barred from marrying gay and lesbian couples in March, Unitarian Universalist ministers have continued to perform a series of those weddings in New Paltz. The first two to do so, Kay Greenleaf and Don Sangre, also face misdemeanor charges, and their case will be heard by the other New Paltz town judge later this month.
Another New York mayor has acted against the interests of same-gender couples. New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg last week vetoed a so-called equal benefits bill that fully 90% of the city council had supported, similar to legislation pioneered by San Francisco and adopted by a few other U.S. cities since. The New York City bill would have required any group with a city contract of at least $100,000 to extend the same benefits to its workers' domestic partners as it offers the spouses of legally married employees. Under Bloomberg's predecessor, Mayor Rudy Giuliani, New York City established registered domestic partnerships carrying all the benefits of marriage the city has jurisdiction to offer, and went on to extend those benefits to couples who had registered their partnerships elsewhere. But Bloomberg wrote that, "On both legal grounds and policy grounds, our administration has opposed such efforts in the past and must continue to do so, despite our support for the general intention of the bill." Actually, during his 2001 campaign, he told activists that he would support an equal benefits ordinance. Although the city council is apt to override his veto soon, it's expected that Bloomberg will act to block implementation of the ordinance.
Jamaica is mourning the loss of its most visible gay activist, Brian Williamson, who was found brutally murdered in his own home this week. His body was mutilated by multiple wounds in an apparent machete attack. Because his apartment was ransacked, police believe robbery was the motive. They're questioning one of 2 men who had asked him for money on the day of his death. But homophobia may have been the reason he was targeted, or at least a contributing factor, according to local activists and to the human rights group Amnesty International. Just a week before the murder, Amnesty had announced an international mobilization against what it called Jamaica's climate of violence and discrimination against lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people, urging repeal of the nation's sodomy law. Amnesty has received numerous reports of violence against lesbian, gay, and trans people in Jamaica, with allegations that police are often unresponsive or even complicit. Williamson was a co-founder of JFLAG, the Jamaica Forum for Lesbians, All Sexuals, and Gays, the first and only such advocacy group in the nation. For years, he was Jamaica's only gay activist willing to use his real name in the media. He also ran the lesbi-gay club Entourage out of his own home. Human rights groups praised his courage, and the many friends who gathered outside his home to mourn praised his kindness, generosity, and hospitality as well.
And finally, Broadway's annual Tony Awards this week were more than ever rife with nominations and wins for gay-themed material and openly gay artists. Non-gay host Hugh Jackman performed Not the Boy Next Door from The Boy from Oz as a sample of his award-winning portrayal of the late gay Australian singer-songwriter Peter Allen. He pulled Sarah Jessica Parker into the act, and when she asked open gay Nathan Lane if he were jealous, Lane said, "He won't return my calls." Among numerous gay jokes, Jackman was even hit on by one of the gay puppets from Best Musical winner Avenue Q. But at least as Peter Allen, Jackman's heart belonged to the venue, historic Radio City Music Hall. Noting that it has one of the biggest organs in the world, he sighed, "What more could a boy ask for?"
That's News Wrap for the week ending June 12, 2004. Follow the news in your area. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is written by Cindy Friedman and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles. For This Way Out, I'm Christopher Gall.
And I'm Cindy Friedman.
As eulogies for former U.S. President Ronald Reagan reverberate, one gay activist shares an alternative remembrance later in the program. It's becoming more and more dangerous to be gay or lesbian in Uganda. Homosexuality is illegal there, as it is in most African nations, with a maximum penalty of life imprisonment. The church has contributed much to the hostile social and political atmosphere, particularly since the Episcopal Church USA consecrated openly gay Reverend Gene Robinson a bishop last year. Anglican leaders in Uganda have joined many others in condemning the confirmation, and the ecclesiastical tensions naturally spill over into the public sphere. At the same time, Ugandan lesbians and gays have been somewhat emboldened by news of liberation movements elsewhere in the world. As Radio Netherlands' Eric Boschemann reports, however, their courage comes with a price tag.
This bar in downtown Kampala, the capital of Uganda, is a popular meeting place for gays. On weekends, a few dozen men drop in here. It's one of the few places where they can be themselves. Outside, they face rejection, persecution, and even torture. John is a 23-year-old. In 1999, the authorities were tipped off that he was living together with another man. In the middle of the night, intelligence officials raided their house and took them to a detention center.
At first, they kept on urinating on us, not giving us food, no light in the rooms. Then they bring about two dead bodies rotting and stuff.
Two dead rotting bodies?
Yeah, they put them there. I don't know. They think we have maybe information with other organizations out of the country which are giving us money and stuff. So after I protested to them and they had me so much, they fought with me, they flogged me. Then afterwards they showered me in some solutions, I don't know, the chemical. After we moved out of the detention house, my skin started rotting.
Rotting?
Rotting, yeah. So it took about 6 months till I got healed and now these are some kind of scars.
John removes his shirt to show the scars on his back and arms. He's still frightened of the authorities and what they would do if they found out he was meeting a foreign journalist. John has good reason to be afraid, says a human rights researcher working in Uganda.
A number of those people have either disappeared, and that is code for being taken by people in civilian clothes who are armed, who are driving away in an unmarked vehicle to an unknown location, which in Uganda is called a safe house. And Ugandan people know that in these safe houses, people get tortured in some of the most barbaric and brutal ways.
For instance?
Well, let me tell you that I've been inside the prison and I've had it described to me how people are tied kandoya. Tied kandoya means that first of all, your wrists are tied together behind your back. Then your ankles are tied to your wrists. And you're probably naked. And then you'll be beaten in this condition. And some people never walk again. The Liverpool treatment is where somebody is restrained in some way, and it might be tied kandoya. They are forced to drink copious amounts of water, and this can be until they die or they may be beaten to death.
It's generally political opponents of the government who are subjected to this type of treatment, but the human rights worker, who asked to remain anonymous, has been hearing of cases where gays and lesbians have also been tortured or even killed while in police custody. The government began to crack down on homosexuals in 1999, after two Ugandan men decided to get married in a suburb of the capital. The gay marriage was widely covered in the Ugandan press and caused outrage, as I heard from Pastor Brown, an Anglican minister who was excommunicated because of his homosexuality.
It was one of the pubs, a place called Wandegeya. So when the wedding was going on, it was overjoyment. So straight people came in and they called the police. The police came, they arrested the couple that was wedding and other guys. So when the news reached the president that homosexuals are coming out even to have weddings, so the president was so furious and angry, and he ordered the police to carry out investigation and arrest all the gays and lesbians that had been to the wedding.
But the police didn't only arrest the participants at Uganda's first gay wedding. President Yoweri Museveni ordered them to lock up all homosexuals and to bring charges against them for engaging in so-called abominable acts. No one knows how many people have been detained or tortured as a result of the president's directive. But according to the human rights investigator, the crackdown was primarily designed to divert public attention from more pressing issues.
The police are very under-resourced, and really important crime issues which affect the welfare of the people of this country are not being addressed. You can go to a police station and you can find there's not a single telephone, not even a filing cabinet. You can't get the officer on the front desk to write everything down in the incident book reliably. So I think that they really would only pursue this issue when there is a political agenda. And of course, if you have a lot of talk about people being corrupt, or if there are opponents of the government being persecuted, why not go and pick on the gays and have a bit of a kerfuffle going along about that issue to take people's minds off other things?
Diversionary tactic.
A diversionary tactic, very much so.
Today, the persecution is less intense than in 1999. But gays and lesbians still live in fear, not only of their government, but also of their own communities. Public humiliation is a common response when Ugandans discover that someone in their midst is homosexual. In December, an 18-year-old high school student was caned in public when the school authorities discovered that she was lesbian. A few days later, she was dead. Initially, it was reported that she had committed suicide, but later it emerged that she had probably died from the beating she received at the school. A similar punishment was meted out to two teenagers at a Pentecostal church.
One of the boys was 16 years old, and another one who was, I think, about 18, were both taken in front of the whole congregation of this Pentecostal church and flogged in public at the behest of the pastor, who's supposedly a man of God. This was carried out by off-duty police officers. The police officers, of course, are guilty of assault, and the whole community who watched this happen have really had imprinted on them a hatred of gays, or at least it seems that must have been the intent.
Although the situation for gays and lesbians in Uganda sounds grim, activists still believe they can turn the tide of repression. Tune in for the conclusion of Eric Beauchemin's report next time on This Way Out.
Brother to brother, brother to brother, brother to brother, brother to brother.
This is Essex Hemphill, reminding you that you've tuned into This Way Out, the international gay and lesbian radio magazine with Lucia Chappell and Greg Gordon.
Turn me around, keep on walking, keep on talking.
My name is Matt Foreman. I'm executive director of the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force. And on the day that Ronald Reagan died and I was watching TV with all the amazingly or shockingly positive coverage of his administration, I wondered what to do. And I thought about it for a while, and I decided the best way to respond would be to write a letter to my best friend, Stephen Pazner, who was dear friend of mine from law school and president of the New York City Lesbian and Gay Center from 1992 to 1994. Dear Stephen, I so much wish you were here today to tell me what to do. You would know if it's right to comment on the death of former President Reagan, or if I should just let pass the endless accolades to his greatness. But you're not here. The policies of the Reagan administration saw to that. Yes, Stephen, I do feel for the family and friends of the former president. The death of a loved one is always a profoundly sad occasion, and Mr. Reagan was loved by many. I have tremendous empathy and respect for Mrs. Reagan, who lovingly cared for him through excruciating years of Alzheimer's. But sorry, Stephen, even on this day, I'm not able to set aside the shaking anger I feel over the Reagan's non-response, the AIDS epidemic, or for the continuing anti-gay legacy of his administration. Is it personal? Of course. AIDS was first reported in 1981, but President Reagan could not bring himself to address the plague until March 31, 1987, at which time there were 60,000 reported cases of full-blown AIDS and 30,000 deaths. I remember that day, Stephen. You were staying round the clock in Memorial Sloan Kettering Hospital, caring for your dying partner of over 15 years, Bruce Cooper. It was another 41 agonizing days for both of you before Bruce died. During those years of White House silence and inaction, how many other dear friends did we see sicken and die hideous deaths? Is it personal? Yes, Stephen. I know for a fact, that you would be alive today if the Reagan administration had mounted even a tepid response to the epidemic. If protease inhibitors had been available in July of 1990, I wouldn't feel so angry if the Reagan administration's failing was due to ignorance or bureaucratic ineptitude. No, Stephen, we knew then it was deliberate. The government's response was dictated by the grip of evangelical Christian conservatives who saw gay people as sinners and AIDS as God's well-deserved punishment. Remember, the White House Director of Communications, Patrick Buchanan, once argued in print that AIDS is nature's revenge on gay men. Reagan's Secretary of Education, William Bennett, and his domestic policy advisor, Gary Bauer, made sure that science, and basic tenets of Christianity for that matter, never got in the way of politics or what they saw as God's work. Even so, I could let go of this anger if it was just another overwhelmingly sad chapter in our nation's past. It is not, Stephen. Can you believe that the unholy pact President Reagan and the Republican Party entered into with the forces of religious intolerance have not weakened, but grown exponentially stronger? Can you believe that the U.S. government is still bowing to right-wing extremists and fighting condom distribution and explicit HIV education, even while AIDS is killing millions across the world? Or that devout Christians have forced the scrapping of AIDS prevention programs targeted at HIV-negative and gay and bisexual men in favor of unproven abstinence-only-until-marriage initiatives? Or that the Reagan stalwarts like Buchanan, Bennett, and Bauer are still grinding their homophobic axes? No, Stephen, I do not presume to judge Ronald Reagan's soul or heart. He may very well have been a nice guy. In fact, I don't think that Ronald Reagan hated gay people. I'm sure some of his and Nancy's best friends were gay. But I do know that the Reagan administration's policies on AIDS and anything gay-related resulted and continue to result in despair and death. Oh, Stephen, how I wish you were here so much.
Gilbert Ramirez, 31 of Eastford Street, the Bronx, died Thursday of complications due. He was smiling peacefully in his bed, musing on some escapades. Mr. Ramirez was employed by that boy could dance up a storm, and he was arrested Westport for being black. He contested the city of New York for turning its back on people with AIDS. He marched in parades that boy could perform. Gilbert Ramirez never lost hope. He loved his friends, he inspired us all. He hated the Pope. He was a queen, Gilbert was a screaming queen. He had an eye for the best, he dressed at the thrift shops. He always looked mean. That boy could be rude, he out-garlanded Judy. He created a scene. Gilbert was honest, his lies were absurd. He never let us down. We're lucky he was here. Our tears might as well be happy for his 31 years. In his honor, a very serious party will be held at his favorite time, Saturday morning at 3. Gilbert Ramirez is survived by his friends and his lover. Gilbert is survived by me.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the International Lesbian and Gay Radio Magazine. This week, Cindy Friedman, Christopher Gall, Graham Underhill, Fensberry, Rex Walkner, Eric Beauchemin, and Matt Foreman contributed program material. Thanks also to Radio Netherlands and to Brian Goebel, Rita Gonzalez, and Sherry Lunn. Paul Hart sang Obituary from Tom Wilson Weinberg's 1987 musical 10% Review, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. Remember, you can listen to This Way Out anytime online, exclusively on Planet Out. There's a link at our website, thiswayout.org. Some This Way Out operating expenses are funded by grants from Clarissa Pinkola Estes, La Sociedad de Guadalupe Foundation, and the Kicking Acids Fund of the Tides Foundation, and through direct charitable donations from our listeners. We thank you. You too can help keep this program on the air and get some queer history, music, and culture on specially produced CDs in the bargain. For all the details, please log on to thiswayout.org or write to us at Post Office Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening on 2SER Sydney, New South Wales, WLUW Chicago, Illinois, KUNM Albuquerque, New Mexico, and more than 150 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay alive and stay tuned.